And good afternoon and welcome. My name is Jim Miller, and I farm in Belden, Nebraska. I am the Vice Chairman of the United States Soybean Export Council and a Director for the American Soybean Association. I'm honored today to introduce Ambassador Darcy Vetter, a fellow Nebraskan and the Chief Agricultural Negotiator in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Ambassador Vetter will brief us on current status of the wide range of trade issues impacting American agriculture right now, and we'll have time for your questions at the end. In her work as Chief of Agricultural Negotiator, Ambassador Vetter is responsible for bilateral and multilateral negotiations and policy coordination regarding agricultural trade. Prior to her joining USTR, Ms. Vetter served as Deputy Undersecretary at the United States Department of Agriculture, overseeing the department's international activities. Before joining USDA, she served as an international trade advisor on the Democratic staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance, where she advised Chairman Max Baucus and other committee members on trade issues relating to agriculture, the environment, and labor, including the 2008 Farm Bill and pending legislation on climate change. Prior to her work on the Finance Committee, Ambassador Vetter spent 6 years at USTR, most recently as Director of Agricultural Affairs. Ambassador Vetter also served as Director for Sustainable Development in USTR's Environment Office, where she negotiated the environmental provisions of the U.S. Chile Free Trade Agreement and negotiated trade provisions in UN environmental treaties, including the World Summit on Sustainable Development. Ambassador Vetter received her Master's of Public Affairs degree and a certificate in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy from Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and her undergraduate degree from Drake University in Des Moines. She grew up in Nebraska on a family farm. Please welcome Ambassador Darcy Vetter.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for being here. I know this is a busy few days for all of you at Commodity Classic, and so I really appreciate you spending some of your time here this afternoon. You all heard the Secretary this morning and his very passionate outline of why it's so important that we move forward with key items on the President's trade agenda. And he talked in particular about the need for folks to get involved and to take action and to make your voices heard. So I'm going to take it that if you're sitting here, it's because you're ready to join those ranks and you're ready to get involved and take some action and let people know. Your editorial boards, your members of Congress, your neighbors next door, why it is that trade is so important for agriculture's bottom line and for the United States as a whole. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership to start here. Those negotiations are not quite as far along as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but are a key part of our trade agenda, and then focus more on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and on our efforts to get trade promotion authority here today. I know there are many of you working in agriculture trade who are also concerned and interested in issues like our trade with China and other regions of the world, our work in Geneva. I'm happy to talk about those things during Q&A, so don't be shy, and go ahead and pipe up about those issues as well at the end of the session. So, personally, for me, this is an amazing time to be able to have the opportunity to serve you as the Chief Ag Negotiator at USTR. We have the most ambitious trade agenda we've seen in decades, and I get to be part of trying to make that come together, which is just incredible. And if you put the TTIP, that Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, and the TPP, our deal in the Asia-Pacific, together, you have two-thirds of global GDP at the table working on integrating their economies. And if you look specifically at the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, TTIP for short, this is an opportunity to deepen the trading relationship to really integrate further the economies in the United States and the EU. This is already the largest trading relationship in the world. Half of global GDP, those two countries or a group of countries together. $1 trillion of goods and services every year. $4 trillion of investment in each other's economies. If we can create value for every dollar of trade that moves back and forth by removing tariffs, that's a huge deal in and of itself. But by removing those tariff barriers, we actually expand that value as well. We increase opportunity to sell more to those partners. This is a very ambitious deal that we're seeking. Again, high standard deal, that looks not only at reducing tariffs, but looks at cooperation in regulatory areas, transparency in setting trade rules and in tariffs, things that frankly make it difficult to do business in other parts of the world. And of course, the United States and Europe are two countries that are known for having very high health and safety regulations, consumer protections in place. If we can set common standards between us, that provides a great deal of confidence for consumers, a great deal of confidence for farmers who are doing business back and forth, but also becomes the kind of standard that the rest of the world will start to aspire to and to meet as well because of just the pull of our economy. So there's a huge opportunity here. Unfortunately, U.S. agriculture hasn't done as well in Europe as some of our other products have recently. Our relationship is $12.6 billion. Nothing to sneeze at. It's our fifth largest ag export market, but frankly, it should be doing better. It used to be our top export destination. Now it's number five. And why is that? Because, first of all, the EU has been aggressively pursuing other trade agreements with countries around the world, which means those countries now enjoy preferential access to the EU's market. They pay no or low tariffs while we pay their MFN rates, or the basic rate they charge to countries who don't have those agreements. And two, any of you who've tried exporting a number of your grain products to Europe knows that there are a number of non-tariff barriers, particularly SPS barriers, that our products faced when we try to access the European market. So our market share into Europe has actually fallen over the past decade or so, from 15% to 10% just last year. And unlike many other countries where the U.S. agriculture has been that sort of shining example of having a trade surplus with our partners, the EU actually has an ag trade surplus with us. And that's something we think that TTIP can help us to correct. So what are the particular barriers that we're going to go after? Well, there's tariffs, first of all. The average tariff in the EU, 30%. Average tariff in the U.S., only 12% on ag products. A number of their tariffs on industrial goods are quite low, but in agriculture, those tariffs are pretty significant barriers for our products. And those non-tariff barriers I mentioned, key ones would be their regulatory and approval process for biotechnology. They, of course, don't permit the use of some key veterinary drugs and hormones that we think are very beneficial in our meat production, and certain process techniques like pathogen reduction treatments in our slaughter plants that they don't accept those treatments. That makes it hard to export our meat products. The EU also maintains barriers on what are called geographic indications. They are seeking intellectual property protection for a variety of their meats and cheeses, for example, that have a strong identity with a place name, something like Parmigiano Reggiano, for example, closely associated with being from Italy. But what the EU is demanding in many third countries and in the EU as well is that it's not just Parmigiano Reggiano that is protected, it's also Parmesan, the generic name that we have many U.S. brands that have marketed and have produced cheese under that generic name for generations. And we want the opportunity to sell those generic branded cheeses in Europe and in third countries. And in return, we're more than happy to protect their associated place names in the United States for those smaller brands. But right now, there's a real conflict in the way that we recognize that intellectual property, and it will be a key challenge in moving forward in this agreement. But I think important to remember here, as I noted before, part of the reason our market share is falling is that the EU is aggressively negotiating free trade agreements around the world. It has concluded agreements with 35 countries and is negotiating with 12 more. So TTIP is an opportunity for us to make sure we also have preferential access to that market. But now I want to talk a little bit about the TPP. TPP is, frankly, quite close to the finish line, and it's an important agreement that we need to move forward with this year in order to secure access to one of the most dynamic regions of the world. 40% of the global economy is at the table in the TPP. It's one of the fastest-growing regions in the world, and TPP is a living agreement. From the beginning, it was intended as a platform that would grow to other countries in the future. We have 12 countries at the table today. They're willing to reduce or eliminate their tariffs across the broad spectrum of products and sign up to a high-standard agreement that makes commitments on transparency, disciplines state-owned enterprises, looks at regulatory cooperation, commitments particularly in the ag area on SPS measures, making sure they're based on science, and looking at intellectual property protections. There's a special chapter just on small and medium enterprises and how we can make sure that they participate better in the global economy. This is really a high integration deal that creates the kind of standards on labor and in the environment that we would like to see go forward. And once we've concluded and entered into force with those initial 12, it is always intended that others would then join. And they would have to accede to those same high standards, the rules that we set and enact. They would have to accede to join and be part of the party. They would have to lower and eliminate their tariffs as well. We have, again, the 12 countries at the table that you see up here, but we've already seen countries like the Philippines, Taiwan, Korea, Thailand, all expressing interest already to say, as soon as you're finished, I want to be the next in line. So we see this as a huge opportunity now, a growing opportunity later. And why is this important? Well, it's for offense, it's for defense, and it's good foreign policy. Three critical reasons why it's significant. First of all, there's just the economic growth that comes from the agreement itself. The Peterson Institute estimates that $123.5 billion per year in additional exports once the TPP is in force. That's nothing to sneeze at. If you think about all of our agricultural products to the entire world this past year, we're $152.5 billion. An additional $123 billion of exports for the U.S. on top of that is significant. And two, without it, we'll continue to lose market share. We need to stop the backsliding that's occurring. The Secretary referred this morning to 250 trade agreements in the Asia-Pacific region that have been concluded where the United States wasn't at the table and where those countries gave each other preferential access. We need to make sure we have skin in the game. Key example of that is the Japan-Australia Economic Partnership Agreement. That's what they call their free trade agreements. It entered into force January 15th of this year. On that date, Australian beef entered Japan and continues to do so at 8.5 percentage points less tariff than ours does. So after, you know, going through BSE starting in 2003, we finally regained access to that market. We were turning the tide, right? Australia took our market share. We were taking it back. Now we're hit with this. We need to catch back up and get back in the game. And three, we can't forget that economic allies are also allies in other ways, and that the foreign policy relationship we have with countries is deepened by our strong commercial ties. And this, again, it's a dynamic region, and the TPP is part of our rebalancing and that pivot to Asia that the Obama administration has touted. And the Secretary was absolutely right that there is another big country in that region that is looking to set the tone. It's introduced its own model for what an economic partnership should look like through that region, calls it the RCEP, and that, of course, is China. And the agreement that they tout doesn't have any of those standards on labor, on environment, on intellectual property that are so important to us. So we want to lead, and we want to set the rules of the road. The TPP countries are already an incredible source of exports for U.S. products. 40% of the overall exports from our economy and 42% of our ag exports already go to our TPP partners. 4.1 million jobs in the United States currently depend on the exports of goods and services to these countries. And this is, as we said before, a really dynamic region. The Secretary spoke this morning about the importance of a growing middle class. Asia-Pacific region is full of new members of that middle class that will be emerging in the next 15 years, 2.7 billion new customers. 66% of the world's middle class will be in Asia in 2030, and 59% of middle class consumption will be in these markets. And the middle class is important not just for general consumption, but it's particularly important in agriculture, because when people have some disposable cash that they can choose how to spend, they improve their diets. They not only eat more calories, but they eat better calories. They eat fresh fruits and vegetables, and they importantly move toward higher protein diets, dairy, meats in particular. Those are things that we're particularly good at producing here and exporting elsewhere. But all of you who are here for Commodity Classic know that those countries are also developing their own livestock industries. So not only do you have more opportunity to sell feed grains to producers here that they can export at meat, but you'll see increased demand for those feed grains in the TPP countries as well. So you have two new opportunities to support your agricultural productivity there. So again, we're looking to reduce or eliminate tariffs throughout all of these TPP countries, $63 billion worth of exports currently. The largest gains, because of those changes in diet, but also because it tends to be the high-value categories, meats, dairy, fruits and vegetables, processed foods, they tend to have higher tariffs already. So the largest gains you see from these agreements are often in those products, But again, to make those ingredients, a lot of the products that you produce have to be part of that value chain. And it's also important to remember that we are practicing what we're preaching here. The United States is not only the largest agricultural exporter, we're the largest agricultural importer, too. We have strong and healthy diets here in the United States because we can get fresh fruits and vegetables year-round, even when the weather is like it is back in D.C., which is a little too cold for producing some of those things we still like to eat in the wintertime, right? We are the biggest importer of agricultural products, and those are also key ingredients for our value-added ag processors. So this also gives us cheaper, more reliable, transparent access to the ingredients we need, as well as to the exports we're going to send. And that openness is an important example to other countries as we ask them to open their market. And of course, what we are asking for is both improved transparency and science-based regulations for our food and ag exports, where of course we've seen when tariffs go down, there's the temptation that those SPS barriers go up. Well, we want to create disciplines to make sure that those SPS measures can be based on science, that we have the opportunity to comment on them and to help shape them so that they don't become the barriers of the future. And I think TPP is interesting because you have developed economies at the table. You have Japan and Canada, where we're seeking new access, that are already customers for some of our highest value products. We sell them very high quality meats and other processed foods, our feed grains as well. But those dynamic economies we talked about before are also at the table, where we see a value across the spectrum of products, but also a real growing value into the future as their populations can consume more. And exports are, as the Secretary mentioned, a critical source of income across the spectrum for U.S. agriculture. If you look at the U.S. exports as a share of production, you have products like cotton and our tree nuts that are up there at about 80% of our production is exported. Those markets are critical. But even down at the lower end, we're talking over 10% of our corn production, apples, poultry, pork up at 20%. If those markets were to close, think about what that would do to the value you receive and what it does to your bottom line. So we need to both keep those markets open and growing. A key part of farm income, as the Secretary noted, is having access to these markets. And frankly, we need to level the playing field. When we enter into these trade agreements and bring our tariffs to zero, that task is a little less hard for us because our markets, frankly, are relatively open. But if you look at Japan and Vietnam, you're looking at a 19% average agricultural tariff and a 16.2% tariff in Vietnam. They have farther to go. The barriers we face in the markets that we're trying to open are often much higher than ours. So leveling that playing field is particularly important. And the past has shown us that when we enter into these agreements, it really does affect our bottom line and it affects where our trade flows go. The orange lines you see here is the average amount of agricultural exports to markets in the five years before we did a trade agreement with them. The blue line represents the five-year average after that trade agreement was completed. These agreements deliver. I think it's important to look at South Korea, Panama, and Colombia towards the right there. Those agreements haven't even been in effect for 5 years yet, and you can see already what the blue lines are doing. A number of the tariffs, often what we do in a trade agreement is tariffs start at their current level and they phase out over time. And the tougher, the higher the tariff is, the more sensitive the product is, the longer it takes to get to zero. Countries need a little more time to transition. So some of the products that mean the most to us haven't even hit that zero point yet, and yet you can see huge gains in our exports to these countries. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Japan. For those of you who've been watching the press about these trade agreements, you know that Japan's market and access to it has been a key point of contention, and that, frankly, Japan's the level of sensitivity to Japan's exports or to exports into or imports into their market has been something that has been difficult for us. So even though Japan has one of the most protected agricultural markets, it still is one of our best customers. And I think we have to remember that we still find a way to navigate the high tariffs, the restrictive import policies, sometimes very small quotas that Japan has for these products, and they are our number one customer in beef, pork, corn, and wheat, our number two market for rice and vegetables, number three for fruit and wine, and number four for soybeans, six for dairy and for nuts, despite the high tariffs and the other barriers to trade. And typically what Japan does in its free trade agreements is it just doesn't want to talk about agriculture. Certainly not in those six areas. Everywhere you see an X, if you look across the top, those are all the countries that Japan has already negotiated a free trade agreement with. And along at the bottom here, or along the side, are all the sensitive or the sacred products that have been difficult for us to negotiate. And everywhere you see an X, it just means not on the table. Japan refused to negotiate new access for those products. And in some cases, you'll see with Singapore, they immediately eliminated their tariff on pork. They don't make any pork in Singapore. You've got a city state with not a lot of pigs. So where they put those items on the table, it was because they had very little to lose. But I think it speaks to the value of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Japan has put every one of those products on the table and is willing to open their market to them. It speaks to the value of the agreement on rules, on things like intellectual property, on disciplining state-owned enterprises. It speaks to the strategic value of having that alliance of countries in a region that is dynamic and where they are seeking stability and greater integration. And it speaks to the economic value of eliminating tariffs and things that are also important to Japan, that they are willing, for the first time, to say, we're going to allow new access to this market. But frankly, they're not going to wait for us. It was the promise of TPP that got Prime Minister Abe to say that agricultural reform and openness in their ag markets would be a key part of his economic reform policy, or the third arrow in his plan for economic reform. But now they've done the hard work. They've talked to their difficult stakeholders. They've made the preparations to do that market opening. But if we don't get TPP across the finish line, there are others behind us who are negotiating bilateral deals with Japan. Canada is negotiating its own bilateral deal in addition to TPP. Australia just closed its bilateral deal. They are negotiating earnestly with the EU, and the access that they're prepared to provide for us, they will provide to others if we don't complete the TPP. So we need to move forward with this agreement so we don't get further behind. So right now in green, those are their current trade partners. In pink, I recognize the print's a little small here. That's who they're negotiating with today, and the countries that are sort of outlined there in the Middle East are all countries where they're exploring those talks. So that's who is going to be our competition in a Japanese market and who will have preferential access on those key products as well as other products across the board if we don't get TPP across the finish line. And again, it's not just Japan's bilateral deals. It's that the whole rest of the world is creating these regional trade agreements. If you look at 1975, these were the trade agreements that were in place. Basically, you had the EU, you had a customs union in the Caribbean, not a whole lot more. You look at 1995, and you've seen the real expansion. You've got NAFTA over here, Canada, the US, and Mexico, a couple of agreements the US has with Israel, several different lines within the EU, and you're starting to see some integration in Asia. But if you look at the last 20 years, those agreements have really picked up the pace, and countries have. Look at the EU and how integrated it is with the rest of the world. Look at all those new red lines. Everything in red is the last 20 years, all throughout that Asian region, that dynamic region we want to be part of, and we're not connected to it yet. So we need to make sure that if we don't do this, no one's going to wait for us to keep doing it. They'll do it without us. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about what this means for the groups that are here at Commodity Classic. Now, I mentioned before that the big value of the TPP, or the largest gains in tariffs, will typically be from your high-value ag products. Again, your meats, your processed foods. Now, you are key ingredients in those. Typically, the barriers to our feed grains and other grains are a little bit lower, although the processed product end of what you do often faces significant tariff barriers, and that's the case in soybeans. Japan's our third largest market for soybeans, about $1 billion. Japan under the WTO already allows soybeans themselves in duty-free. But you have tariffs up to 20% on other soybeans and other soybean products and oilseed products. So soybean meal, soybean oil still have significant barriers that we're going to bring down through the TPP. Vietnam is the same. Very small tariffs to no tariffs on the beans themselves, but up to 30% on soybean products. Malaysia, small tariffs on both of those kinds of products, although we would like to get that soybean oil tariff to zero as well. So the TPP will give us a much better chance to compete on a level playing field there. on wheat. Japan already, obviously, a very big market for us on wheat. Japan has a very large WTO quota on wheat where that wheat comes in duty-free, but we want to make sure that we maintain and expand that market share through the TPP. Vietnam, tariffs on wheat are low or non-existent, but wheat products, we'd like to see the tariffs come down on those. Malaysia, we have good access for that grain. Corn, we come in largely duty-free in this range, although corn products into Vietnam, again, up to 40% tariffs that we would like to bring down, so we can ship it in whatever form we like. And Malaysia, again, relatively low tariffs, both on corn and corn oil and tariffs as well. Barley, again, comes in duty-free to most of these countries, but some small tariffs we like want to see reduced. And sorghum, we don't export a lot of sorghum to Vietnam, although we do have a good relationship there with Japan under a relatively low tariff scenario. So again, the feed grains themselves will continue to do strong business. A lot of what we're going to ship in, new opportunity will be to ship it in as meat, to be able to ship products where tariffs were prohibited before. But as those livestock industries in those countries increase, we'd like to make sure that they are using our inputs to feed that livestock. But let's not forget that this is an important agreement to complete for strategic reasons as well. Trade, quite frankly, is one of our most important foreign policy tools. Our economic strength is a critical source of our influence throughout the world. Agreements like TPP help further that goal. They rebalance our economic and our political influence throughout the world and are a key part of that pivot to Asia. Again, China has made very clear that it doesn't particularly like the model that we are advocating with the TPP. They have their own model that they would like to see much lower standards on labor, on the environment, on intellectual property, on state-owned enterprises, issues where those high standards will benefit the way we do business. And frankly, if China's vision prevails, in the fastest-growing region in the world, our competitiveness will be at a significant disadvantage. What these agreements do is they integrate supply chains throughout their members. They create stronger both political and economic alliances at key tables like the G20 and the WTO, where we have common interests. And so it diminishes our overall influence to not be part of the game in creating these trade deals. So we can show our leadership here. We can get TPP across the finish line and ensure that the way the global system operates is according to the rules we'd like to see, or others will be very happy to replace that with the model of their own. So where are we? Quite frankly, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is at the end game. Over the last few months, we've seen very significant progress on market access and on rules. There are few issues left at the table, but as with any negotiation, the last ones are the hard ones. So it's going to take a lot of technical creativity and political will to make those last decisions. We've been consulting very closely with Congress. I've been to the Hill pretty much every week since I started this job to make sure that they know where we are, that their priorities are reflected in the way that we try to approach this new market opening. So throughout that process, we've been working very closely. Some of you are cleared advisors on our advisory committee, so we've been calling you at strange times of the night and asking you critical questions about how to move forward and getting your advice to make sure that what we negotiate gives you the best opportunity and makes you most competitive overseas. But ultimately, what's going to drive the timeline is the deal on the table. If we don't think we have a good package, we're not going to stop. We're going to keep negotiating. So the substance drives the timing, but we're getting close to that point where that substance is coming together and the difficult decisions have to be made. But we can't get to that agreement across the finish line without trade promotion authority. And the Secretary talked this morning about the importance of having this critical tool in hand that will allow us to implement and to formally adopt this trade agreement and bring it into force. Trade Promotion Authority is it is authority to pass agreements in a certain way. It allows Congress to tell us not only what are the key objectives, what is it that we expect you to achieve in this trade negotiation, but also how we expect you to achieve it and how we expect you to tell us how you're doing so that you can get input throughout, so that we can tell you if we're happy about the way that you're doing it, about the trade-offs that you have to make. We can provide our advice and our consent as you go forward. And in exchange for for following those rules, for having those defined objectives that we use to approach these negotiations, what Congress agrees to do is to consider at the end of the day, when I shake my partner's hand across the table, that they will consider that deal as a package and not try to amend it on the floor. So they give me some authority to reassure my trading partner that the deal that we strike is the deal, which allows, of course, my partner across the table to put her best deal on the table, because she's sure that it's not going to get unraveled at the end of the day. But it also puts an extra burden on me to make sure that whatever I'm offering and whatever I'm accepting, I've consulted. I've consulted with you, I've consulted with Congress, I've compared that result back to those negotiating objectives that Congress has set for me throughout the process. So I'm confident when I do that handshake that I have something in hand that's going to be good for all of us and for U.S. agriculture. So it's really a two-way partnership on the way that we conduct and the way that we conclude this agreement, and then ultimately the way we vote on it in Congress. And that is what will soon be, I hope very soon, will be presented in both houses of our Congress for consideration. But that authority has to be in place. That vote, that legislation has to pass before an implementing bill for TPP can be considered under these new rules. And there are groups on the right and on the left who would say that trade promotion authority is not the way to go. But I can tell you there's a lot at stake. And while I can't tell you everything that's on the table, I know that there's a really good deal for U.S. agriculture out there in the TPP. I know that there's a huge opportunity for U.S. agriculture out there in TTIP and in our arrangements with Europe. But unless this structure is in place, then I can't get it across the finish line. And so it's really critical that we show our support for trade promotion authority and then ultimately for those trade agreements. So again, I'm happy to take questions on TPA, on TPP, on the negotiating part of our agenda, as well as other issues. So thank you very much. Go ahead.
Here, Ray.
We're going to amplify you, Ray.
They wanted me to stand on the chair, too, so they could see me. So, Darcy, you know, we heard from the Secretary this morning that we all need to work really hard with our legislators to encourage TTP, and I'm trying to ask this in a way that you can answer, maybe. So what are the concerns you've heard from both sides and how we might address those concerns, you know, whether it's, you know, from the right or the left, as you said? Maybe that's a way that you can help us to know who to talk to and how to talk to them.
Well, I don't know if I can recreate all of their concerns, but I can tell you some of the things we frequently hear. And sometimes we hear from our friends on the left that they're concerned about labor and environment standards in these agreements and what the agreements will do to protect them. You might have heard in the introduction that I actually started my career at USTR as an environment negotiator. I negotiated the environmental provisions of the U.S.-Chile Free Trade Agreement, and I can tell you what is in the TPP goes far beyond what we did then. That the strongest environment and labor protections in any trade agreement are present in the TPP, and that those agreements have a real impact in encouraging other countries to make sure they look at how their economic relationships affect the environment and labor, and they put protections in place. And that's important not only for the workers in the U.S. and in those other countries. It's important not only for the environment in both places, but, you know, that it levels the playing field economically as well to know that our trading partners, it's part of the TPP and in the United States, we're meeting strong standards on environment and labor. On the right, sometimes you hear, frankly, there are some people who think this is a priority for Obama, so it just shouldn't be a priority for them. Some of it is strictly partisanship. Some of it is concern that the fast track is somehow not constitutional. It gives away authority that Congress has over making trade deals. Well, I can tell you, I went through earlier the list of things that Congress ensures that we do. Not only the objective that we meet, what's the rule, but how we do it, and how often I have to check in with them to make sure I'm doing it right. When I worked at USDA, I ran multi-billion dollar programs, and Congress asked me about it about once a year when I went up to the Hill for my annual appropriations hearing. How is that working? I go to the Hill every week. I'm talking constantly about the progress that we're making. So in terms of congressional oversight, you know, we've been negotiating the TPP as though TPA were in force, even though that legislation has expired, so that we'd be ready to consider it under those kinds of rules. And I can tell you that the oversight, the involvement, the engagement of members of Congress and their staff throughout the process has been very strong and robust. And it's also important to note that TPA sets out very specific timelines to make sure that Congress has the opportunity to review the legislation. I saw an op-ed in a paper today to say that what Fast Track does is it shoves an agreement through Congress before anyone can look at what's in it. I think Secretary Vilsack pointed out already that any member of Congress today can go at any time and look at what the latest negotiating text says. But the TPA rules also require that before the president signs any trade agreement, there has to be a period of review of that agreement. And then once it's signed and once it goes before committee and before it can go for a vote, there are specific periods of time outlined in the legislation itself to ensure that members can inform themselves and make informed decisions whether to vote yes or vote no. So again, the deliberation is built into the process. Some of the complaints we've heard is that it shoves it through without members being able to consider it, and that's just not the case.
Hi, Darcy. Danny Murphy.
Hi there.
You've had really good news, I think, for agriculture in both Europe and the Pacific. I had really two questions as you were talking about maybe Japan and Canada negotiating a free trade agreement. Is that just a backup for TPP, or is that going to be competition maybe down the road for the TPP or undermine some of the things in TPP? And second question is really, I can see the competition between maybe China and the United States on getting this agreement of who's going to get it done. But if we get the TPP done, will China feel pressure to maybe at one day be part of the TPP?
Well, first of all, I'll do the China and or the Japan and Canada question. You know, what Japan negotiated with Australia that went into effect earlier this year is frankly not ambitious enough for us. We want to see deeper concessions, better access to the Japanese market than what Australia was able to gain. But Australia still has an advantage over us into the Japanese market if we don't conclude TPP. So we expect better gains than that agreement saw. So sort of the pre-TPP negotiation, I think what you see is wanting to get earlier access by those TPP partners, you know, Australia and Japan, getting earlier access into that market. But frankly, Australia expects to benefit from what we get from the TPP, to get deeper gains because with more countries at the table, Japan will give more. But I think it's a different story after, because Japan, in incorporating TPP into its vision of how it wants to reform its economy, has prepared itself to make deeper cuts than it made in its bilateral with Australia. It's prepared itself to take on some agricultural reforms. So if there is no TPP, but there is a Japan-Canada agreement, and there is a Japan-EU agreement, both of which we should expect to be completed, because they are quite far along in those negotiations, Japan will give the concessions they would have given to the TPP to those countries in the future, because they see that greater openness as part of their economic plan. So, you know, I think, you know, again, Japan-Australia was a precursor to the TPP. It didn't provide the kind of access we want. But now that Japan has prepared itself to make those cuts, if we don't take them, someone else will get them. And in your talk about China and the TPP, you know, there are a number of things that China would need to do to be able to meet the kind of standards that we're looking for with the TPP. But if it is enacted and it continues to attract those members, I think in the long run it will be very hard for China not to do so. And I think we are negotiating and keeping in mind the TPP as a platform to really bring in and integrate all of Asia. And, you know, hopefully that's exactly what it will do.
Thank you for your presentation. Just a question about from the perspective of commodity associations and our export groups that are always working to promote trade. What could we be doing better to make your job easier on GMOs and the acceptance of U.S. biotechnology?
Gosh, you know, that has obviously been something I've been working on my whole career in trade, is trying to make other countries take perhaps more of an objective and a scientific view toward that technology. I think some of the things we can do is you can work closely with the tech providers to make sure that you're both sharing the same information. I think the United States, we have to make sure that our technology and the materials needed for approval of that technology, the dossiers, the applications, are all submitted immediately in all the export markets so that they can be considered. But one of the things you absolutely can do is to talk very clearly about the benefits that accrue to you as producers and the benefits that we're starting to see in that second generation of products that accrue to consumers as well, and why it is that you feel comfortable, including biotechnology, in the work that you do. I think it's one thing for me to say, hey, the science says this, you know, to government, why? You should accept it. It's another thing entirely when producers talk to each other and say, here's how I found that this affects the job that I do on my farm. And so I think continuing your outreach in that way is particularly important. One of the hardest things to do for governments is good risk communication. And, you know, something like GMOs have this, you know, long technical name. You can talk about why the science tells you yes or no, but producer stories and experiences are far more compelling. So as you continue your work, please do that. And then you've all done very, very good work with other like-minded countries who are using this technology, who don't need to be convinced, but who can be very powerful voices in conjunction with the United States to ask other governments to make sure and adopt better policies. So efforts like the International Soy Exporters, MAISOL, what you've done with Brazil and Argentina to jointly approach governments like China and the EU to say, we, as your main suppliers, all think this is an important part of our equation. Please change your policies accordingly. It's one thing for the U.S. to ask. It's another when we ask as a group. So please keep those activities going strong.
I've got a question. You know, you mentioned the geographic indicators as part of TTIP, you know, and the I believe I'm correct in that the bilateral agreements that Europe has signed with a number of countries have very broad geographic indicator and issues. Have you looked at that as in the context of the WTO as far as if they're overstepping what they, you know, if we have a, you know, the case in point would be if I understood the agreements right, like their agreement with Canada not only, you know, restricted them from importing anything from the U.S. that had that traffic. Geographic indicate, you know, I mean.
I think what the U.S.-Canada agreement did was sort of grandfather in the use. So if U.S. exporters were already sending product to Canada, for example, that used a generic term that was related to sort of the single name relation to a larger geographic indication, a Parmesan versus a Parmigiano Reggiano, for example, it could continue to do so. But new trademarks or new registration of intellectual property using that generic term would not be allowed. We do not see the CETA, the Canada-EU trade agreement model, as applicable to what we want to do going forward. We think that's too restrictive for the U.S. But you are absolutely correct that it's not just what we do with the EU and how we can sell products into their market. It's the way that the EU is trying to enforce their geographical indications more broadly than they should in third countries. We've been working with countries in Central America where we felt our market access we gained through CAFTA was being undermined by the way the EU was pushing them to enforce. So we have broad bilateral outreach there. And we're working in the TPP to make sure that the EU, who's negotiating with all of those countries as well, doesn't come in and undermine the market access that we gain. So we're doing that in a couple of ways. One is we are looking at language in the TPP that would define what is a generic. Because different countries' intellectual property laws do that in a different way. But if we can all agree on what are generic terms, a generic type of cheese like Parmesan or feta or brie, once those are recognized as generic, you can't then go in and trademark them or refuse to allow them to be sold and in commerce. So we're working with countries that way. And we're trying very hard, and frankly, it's a bit of an uphill battle in the negotiations. It's an open issue to try to get all countries to put in place a system that would allow for challenge and opposition. If a GI was being registered in that country, that would basically block access for goods that were already in commerce. So in the United States, if you try to register a trademark and that name is already being used, you can provide comments and say, wait a second, This name is already fully traded in the marketplace. It can't be protected. You can't restrict my right to use it. We're asking for a similar procedure to be put in place in all the TPP countries so that GIs aren't registered that stop legitimate commerce from occurring. So we are not working on this just bilaterally. We are looking globally at how to protect that U.S. market access for meats and cheeses. It applies to wines and other products as well, but meat and cheese are kind of top of the list.
So, Ambassador Vetter, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for being here today, and I appreciate you being a champion for agriculture. You've mentioned, and we've talked about the EU and the biotech restrictions and the frustrations there, and just want to, I guess, tease up and ask about, you know, what are the next steps? While we have basically a de facto moratorium going on, we have 13 pending events. It's been a year and a half since the EU has approved an event. Can the administration communicate to the new EU Commission, which I know wants to make a fresh start, that, you know, we can't continue business as usual in negotiating a trade agreement while you have a moratorium in place in violation of your WTO commitments?
We can communicate it, and we have communicated it. As recently as last week, the new EU Agriculture Commissioner Hogan was in town. I know that that issue was raised with him both by Secretary Vilsack and Ambassador Froman, that those 13 pending approvals need to be dealt with. They need to operate their system as intended. We have made that message very clear. What we have hoped and what we had set up, it's not just, we face a lot of SPS barriers going into the EU, biotechnology being a very significant one of them. But frankly, the EU has some frustrations with some SPS barriers they face on their products coming to us. And part of the negotiation process was supposed to be some confidence-building measures on both sides of the Atlantic to say, hey, can we make some progress on these issues that have been outstanding? Can we create a little bit of momentum, a sense of goodwill and good faith, that we really do intend to break down barriers in a way that will let our ag relationship deepen? And this, frankly, is a bit of the thorn in the side of that process. And, you know, one of my jobs as a negotiator is not just to get a good deal, but to make sure all my stakeholders feel like that good deal is going to be worth something at the end of the day. And that is one of the messages we've communicated, is that this delay on an issue where we've gone to the WTO in the past and are not seeing progress makes it very hard to convince people like you that we're really serious about creating an opportunity to normalize trade in the products of biotechnology. So we will continue to communicate that, and we will continue to look at all of our options across the spectrum as to how we alleviate this backlog.
Darcy, again, thank you. I'm all eternal optimistic you're going to conclude some really great trade agreements, but my question is do you anticipate that we need to be prepared for TAA, Trade Adjustment Act, reauthorization, as we did before the last time we took free trade agreements to the Hill for a vote?
My understanding is that a TAA bill has already been introduced. We may see another version of TAA coming forward, and in the past, TPA has typically moved forward with some version of trade adjustment assistance as well. While it doesn't, sometimes they've moved in tandem. During my time on the Hill, that was part of the discussion, would TPA and TAA move forward as a package? It doesn't look like that will happen this time, but providing some sort of adjustment assistance for individuals whose jobs are affected by trade in a negative way, new job training, new opportunities to participate in jobs that are created by trade agreements, even if theirs was affected. That has typically been something to help spur TPA, to help spur and garner support for particular trade agreements. So they've often moved in tandem, and that it may be the case now that those two bills move in similar timing, but that's for Congress to decide. So,
what is the most effective call to action now for all of our commodity groups, grassroots members? Is it to make calls to their congressmen, contact them when they're in the district, or, as the Secretary said this morning, we need to do something, or is it to write editorials in our local paper? What do you think at this point we should be doing?
All of the above. I think that, frankly, it's very, it's one thing to get 1,200 copies of the same email or 1,200 people who call and read the script about something. Having worked on the Hill myself, I know it means a lot when somebody comes in and said, this is what I do for a living and this is how this affects me. And I think farmers are particularly well placed to say, my farm income, the prices I see every day really depends on access to global markets. So I think you're particularly strong advocates because of the very direct impact that access to international markets has on your bottom line. And I think, you know, we talked earlier today in the general session, it wasn't the secretary who talked about it, but a lot of the presidents of your organizations talked about the fact that a lot of our consumers have no attachment to the farm still. They don't know what it's like. And so if you are out there talking to your editorial boards, if you're writing letters to the editor, writing those editorials yourself, you have a chance to educate a lot of your friends and neighbors about what it means to be a farmer. And the fact that despite what they think about rural America, you are all some of the most engaged people in the global economy that there are because of the way that commodity markets move. So you have an amazing chance to educate people about what these trade agreements really mean. So I hope that you'll do all of the above in order to help us get the tools in place and get the agreements themselves across the finish line.
Hello. Say, I just wanted to ask, what would be the value here in both these agreements if we had low-level presence policy in place? And where do you see that fitting in?
That's not something that we're negotiating at the table in these agreements. These agreements really focus on sanitary and phytosanitary standards themselves and how countries set them, but also about the tariffs specifically. But we are very much aware of your work on low-level presence. We're participating actively as the U.S. government in looking at those policies. One of the ways that these things can interact would be, you know, if we are encouraging and we're asking countries at the negotiating table to commit to setting their SPS measures based on science, that should help them set up approval systems for biotechnology that operate in a more timely and predictable fashion, which, of course, in the long run, should decrease the asynchrony we see in the time it takes to get a biotech product approved in one market and another, and then creates the need for these LLP policies. So, I think the regulatory strengthening we see in these trade agreements will help with these kinds of efforts that you're working on, but they're not directly overlapping. But I think we need to continue to work on both fronts to have a better understanding, frankly, among regulators and among decision makers at the border about how the grain trade really moves and why LLP policies are not asking countries to sort of ignore their regulations, but rather to take note of the fact that as this grain trade moves, these are instances that do not have an effect on public health or safety, but are just part of the way that this cargo moves, and we need to find a practical way to deal with it. So that's the engagement that we're looking to have with you and with other countries and move forward with that. Other questions? This is not a shy group, I know. So
what type of a time frame are we looking at that if we don't get these signed? What kind of a time frame will it be too late that Canada and Australia will have theirs signed and we'll be behind the eight ball on them?
Frankly, we need to get this done this year. We need to see TPA legislation move this spring, and we need to continue to move into that and consider the TPP agreement as a whole yet this year as well. That's important not only for substantively to take advantage of that momentum and get countries to the table to make that deal, but it's also the case that both the U.S. political calendar, frankly, if you get into 2016, there's other distractions on the table for the U.S. that will make it hard to move big legislation in an election year. And we're not the only country who has the similar timeline and constraints. A lot of the other countries at the table have a similar need to move forward with these agreements as soon as possible. So it's go time. We need to see the TPA introduced soon, and we want to see it passed. And the fact that we're discussing TPA, that the U.S. is putting in place the tools that it needs to finalize and implement an intern to force with TPP, is actually adding to the momentum at the table in the TPP negotiations themselves. Countries are readying themselves to make those agreements a reality. And so there's a real palpable sense of momentum at the negotiating table that now is the time to conclude. So we need to do our part here at home to make sure that we can make that a reality with the other trading partners as well. Any other questions?
Well, seeing no other questions, got your last chance here. We'd just like to thank Ambassador Vedder for being here today and sharing her expertise with us, and thank her for all the hard work that you do on the trade negotiations and trying to get this accomplished for us. So let's give her a hand for good work that she does.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.